There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss. There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
He sipped at a weak hock and seltzer as he gazed at the London skies, through the Nottingham lace of the curtains, or was it his bees-winged eyes? John Betjeman, the arrest of Oscar Wilde at the Cadogan Hotel. So as usual, I've opened the front door and grabbed the first two likely-looking Londoners who happen to be out there.
It does seem that everyone's got a story to tell.
I think screaming does help as well.
Ooh, yes, the Horniman Walrus.
They dug out bodies in 1887, 1873.
What did he look like when he came out the other end of that?
Knackered.
Got Sarah Palin coming. How do you feel about that?
A little bit pathetic.
So we're in the parlour of Dr. Johnson's house.
One sees a story that is both of protests and of coming together.
So they're banning people from bringing food to homeless.
Yeah, they're banning soup runs.
You know, we weren't buckled by the tailors.
A word in your eye, don't worry or push. A step in the gate is worth two in the bush.
Which area of ridiculousness do we start on with that story? Why would you give a medal to a pigeon?
Listen, you're all idiots. You don't understand culture or anything.
No running, no throwing. This is pretty serious stuff.
You engage with other people, you link across to other people.
It's just huge. It's gigantic.
How many times have you done this so far?
That depends.
What do you think of that approach?
I think that's terrible.
London life is a really rich experience, and there's a lot that's good about living
Boris here. Boris Johnson.
He weighs as much as 40 school children.
What a peculiar conversation. Hello, it's Monday, August 27th, 2012. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe, and this is Londonist Out Loud, a podcast of news, views and curiosities from London, UK. You can, as always, download the show free on iTunes, hook up on Facebook at Londonist Out Loud, or tweet me at Londonist Sound. I've got an interview, the like of which you are not going to hear elsewhere for you today. It's an extended interview in our summer series. I'm going to be speaking to Murray Craig, who is the clerk of the Chamberlain's Court at Guildhall. Well, what does he do, I hear you ask? I can only advise that you listen to the interview. The answer is a long and complicated one, but I hope very interesting and absolutely unique. And we are sponsored once again this week by riverford.co.uk, and they are, as you may well remember, a deliverer of vegetables. Yes, if you want a box of broccoli and spuds and carrots and other delicious things brought to you, and indeed meat and fruit as well, then Riverford is the company for you. And we've teamed up with them to offer you some free food. All you need to do is go to riverford.co.uk/Londonist and you'll get a half price vegetable box. Delivery is free on all of this stuff. It's free seasonal organic veg, fruit and meat delivered to you for half price thanks to Riverford and Londonist. So what's been going on in the capital in the last week? Well, quite a bit. Even though it's summer and therefore silly season, I guess things are starting to switch back now to a slightly more work-like pace. And indeed, Boris has climbed down from his zip wire and has started to come up with some schemes, of course, being that it's Boris, they are transport-related. And the latest wheeze is one for the cyclists. What he's come up with, basically, is an idea of setting down trackside, as in rail trackside, cycle paths. So these are going to be dedicated to two-wheeled transport, and thereby avoid all of the deadly HGVs, red lights and so forth, in the capital's general traffic flow. A fairly complicated sort of arrangement to set up. Londonist writers have, of course, done a little bit of investigation of their own, and it only took a trip or two on the train looking out the window to spot some of the problems. Bridges, for one, Clapham Junction, for another, where, of course, to have a trackside cycle path would mean having to get rid of some of the other tracks. Will it work? Not entirely sure. Of course, Boris has also been a proponent of elevated cycleways. So all of this seems to boil down to a lot of brainstorming and clearly an intent to make sure that those people who do want to cycle in the town and thereby perhaps relieve some of the congestion, particularly around rush hours, should have a safe way to get from A to B. The debate is most definitely underway in the Londonist article about it this week. If you take a look at How Would Boris's Railway Cycle Paths Work, check out that article and you'll find quite a few comments there already, some in support, others objecting, and others simply, I think, seeing this as the beginning of a conversation that needs to happen. Now, another conversation that's long overdue is, of course, about affordable rent in the capital. And London Assembly member Darren Johnson wants your help in coming up with a definition of an affordable rent. You may remember, before the election, London citizens got Boris Johnson to agree to work with them and with local authorities to decide what an affordable rent should be. And this is the important distinction. It's based on income, not on market rates. Well, so far there hasn't been much action from the Mayor's office. We already know that at least one pre-election pledge on housing didn't manage to come to Boris's attention. So Darren has decided to move matters along, and he publishes a handy and slightly terrifying tool that lets you work out which boroughs you can actually afford to rent in. The Mayor and government currently define affordable as 35% of your take-home pay, and Darren wants your ideas on how to make that definition better, as well as things City Hall can do to make London affordable for us all to live in. And there's, of course, a feedback form there as well, so you can submit more general comments, and the place to take a look at for that is londonrents.org.uk. Well, still on the subject of buildings, but not homes this time. As you may be aware, every year there's an open house weekend. It's happening in September this year, and it's got increasingly popular as more and more people have become aware of it. So much so that this September's open house weekend has already encountered some fairly massive technical problems in terms of the booking system. It's crashed under high traffic at least twice. It experienced so much demand last Thursday it couldn't cope. Bookings were suspended, and they tried to start it up again the next day, but that didn't happen either. And consequently, there's been a lot of upgrading and testing going on there. Now, you might be interested to know that Open City, which runs the weekend, is in fact a charity. And despite the fact that they're putting pressure on their internet provider, of course, there's only so much they can do. So a little understanding is, of course, very useful for them. You can keep an eye on their progress via their website or Twitter. You can sign up for their newsletter if you want to find out when online booking will reopen. A few hints here. The Gherkin cannot be pre-booked, so there's no point piling onto the website to try to get that one. That's just a case of queuing. Other popular spots that are available via email ballot only are Heron Tower, Tower 42, the Lower Lee, and ICE Saturday and Sunday boat tours. So if it's on water or up high, you're going to have to take your chances with everyone else. Quite a useful resource here as well, Ian Visits. Ian Visits, of course, is a blog that's very popular and does very much what it says on the tin in relation to London. He has a list going on of details of buildings that you won't be able to book via the Open House website, and hopefully that will help reduce a little bit of traffic for them and get a few extra hits for him. So do take a look on there before you go to the Open House weekend website, which of course is openhouselondon.org.uk. Well, here's a news story I'm glad to read. New wheelchair advice has been given to bus drivers. You may remember a few weeks ago we were covering the story of one particular would-be user of London buses who is a wheelchair user. His name is Ray Belisario. And Ray, of course, was told 28 times that he was not going to be able to board various buses. He was sworn at. He was assaulted. The most graphic image from his story for me was that he had his legs in the doors of a bus which had tried to drive off without him, and the driver was there kicking his legs out from the doors of the bus. Quite disgusting. There's also been stories, muscular dystrophy sufferer Ollie Knocker says he is late for work twice a week because drivers won't let him get on board with his mobility scooter. Jonathan Byrne, meanwhile, had to pay £73 for new train tickets after a driver prioritised an empty pram over him, and he consequently missed the connection home. Well, TfL have reminded their drivers, and it's long overdue that the wheelchair space on buses is for wheelchairs. Yeah, not buggies. And buggies, of course, should be folded if a wheelchair user needs to board, nor are those spaces for people standing or for luggage. And they've issued an illustrated guide to permitted chairs and scooters, which complements a mobility card that's been issued to disabled people earlier in the year. Now, that's all well and good, and of course it is good, and not before time, but I think the onus falls on us as well. Yes, of course, there's a professional responsibility for the driver to ensure that he is handling his customers in the appropriate way. But, I think it comes down to all of us as bus users to stick up for the rights of every passenger. You wouldn't leave a pregnant woman standing there if she wanted a seat. Well, similarly, if the bus driver is being less than helpful, I think it's beholden on all of us to, put our two penneth in. There's a comment as well from someone who wants to do just that. Bernard says, do you or any readers have a copy of the mobility card that you can share? I'm happy to wade in, he says, when it comes to this sort of thing, but I'd like to feel a little better informed. So, yeah, please do go onto the londonist.com story there if you are disabled and you're able to share what that mobility card looks like and which sort of scooters, etc., are allowed on the bus. That would be welcome information. Well, the team here has been spending the last few weeks booking the guests for the new series. We've got some fantastic ones. I'm sure you're going to want to hear their views and their insights into their work. We've, amongst other things, got a beef eater, a lifeboatman, a professional skeptic, and a historian of prisons, among many, many others. Do stay tuned in future weeks to Londonist Out Loud, and of course do check out londonist.com for all the news stories that we discuss on this show. Before we hear from Murray Craig, there's just time for this week's historical quiz. Are you ready? And of course answers will come after the interview at the end of the show. So, the last week in London, 20th of August 1989, the Marchioness disaster took place on the Thames, resulting in 51 deaths. Under which bridge did that happen? Tuesday, the 21st of August 1920, a boy was born in Chelsea, West London. His father, the author A.A. Milne, would use him as inspiration for a character in the Winnie the Pooh stories. What was the boy's name? Wednesday, 22nd of August, 1964. Which iconic football programme was screened for the first time, covering on its first day a 3-2 defeat of Arsenal by Liverpool? There can surely be only one, right? Thursday, the 23rd of August, 1940. The first what takes place in London? A lot of stuff happening for the first time there, of course. Clue, it happens at night. Or in this case, it happened at night. Finally, Friday, the 24th of August, 1931, at Westminster, Prime Minister Ramsay MacDonald submitted the formal resignation of the Labour government. What was the Labour government replaced by? Okay, you've got about 40 minutes to see what you can do with those. Incidentally, if you are interested in puzzles and memory, you might be interested in the Londonist article Nifty Mnemonics, which is... there's some good stuff here. There's no answers, though, to the quizzes they set there, but it's a bunch of mnemonics that help you to remember certain sequences around town. Just type in Nifty Mnemonics into londonist.com and you'll see what I mean there. There's a certain irony there, isn't there, given that mnemonics, which is, of course, all about using first letters to help you remember stuff, the word mnemonics itself has an almost silent first letter. Well, let me introduce you now to a man who has no memory problems whatsoever. He has plenty to say about his role and indeed about the history of the City of London and the many organisations existing within it. Well, here I am at Guildhall, And the room I'm in, which I believe is in the North Wing, I guess you would think of a courtroom, something like an American courtroom drama feel to it. It's about as close as I can get. At one end of the room, there's a very large lectern, a winged lectern. There's a crest on the wall. There's a list of chamberlains of London on both sides of the wall behind it, which sort of gives away where we are. I am with the clerk of the Chamberlain's Court, Murray Craig, today. Hello.
Hello.
Good afternoon.
And we're here really to dig into your role, which, as niche careers go, it is very, very, very special indeed. How many people are there doing anything like what you're doing?
I hesitate to answer that. I know that I'm only the 37th clerk of the Chamberlain's Court since 1294, and to be honest, I don't think the freedom... I think freedom is dispensed in other towns and cities about the country, but they tend to do it, I think, perhaps annually or biannually, something like that, whereas here it's a daily occurrence for us in the City of London.
OK, so we need to define our terms, first of all, I suppose. So the giving of freedom is the first thing, I guess, to unpack a little bit for those who are unfamiliar with it. And obviously we could go straight into the sort of the clichéd understanding that people have of what the freedom of the City of London means.
Sure. Well, it's a very ancient custom, a tradition that we're very proud of at the Guildhall and keen to maintain as a living tradition. Its origins actually stretch back to the early part of the 13th century. And the freedom, in fact, was a working document. It was the right to trade. It would enable you to carry out your trade or your craft as a member of one of these livery companies or guilds of the City of London, trade associations of a craft banded together to look after the interests of their members. That's essentially what a livery company is, nothing to do with horses. To carry out your trade or craft, you had to have a bit of parchment, a bit of paper, which is the freedom. And this would give you, it was very lucrative, it would give you monopolistic trading rights in the richest part of the kingdom, the City of London, which all sounds marvellous, but there were two catches. One, the fee, and historically the fee was quite high proportionally in comparison with the rather modest sum that's charged today, which I hasten to add doesn't swell the coffers of the corporation anymore, but goes to the Freeman's School at Ashstead in Surrey for the foundation scholarships. And then secondly, the guilds would undertake to maintain standards of excellence and quality in the goods produced and the services provided. So bakers wouldn't give you stale bread, and vintners wouldn't give you sour wine, butchers wouldn't give you rotten meat. In essence, therefore, the freedom was a sort of a medieval type of quality control or trading standards. And this lasted for centuries until the Victorians came along. And of course, they didn't like monopolies and cartels. They liked free trade, laissez-faire. So the requirement that you be a member of a guild or a livery to obtain the freedom was lifted in 1835. And the freedom was enlarged or expanded upon to enable anybody living or working in the city to get the freedom. So since 1835, we've had the two strands of freedom, the one via a livery company and the one by nomination.
And freedom now then means what in practical terms? When I arrived here, you were just at the tail end of a ceremony, and I can see that it's an honour. But in practical terms, is it possible to use the freedom for something?
To be honest, it's largely symbolic today. Ever since the rules were changed, as I mentioned, in the Victorian era, it remains a unique slice of London history, a very potent symbol of London history. And strictly speaking, it isn't an honour. Some people perceive it to be an honour, but it's more, I would say, a slice of London history. They get their piece of parchment, a book called The Rules for the Conduct of Life, which was written by a former Lord Mayor in the 18th century for the benefit of his wayward young apprentices. And there is what I would hope is a very interesting, people seem to go and tell me they find it a very interesting ceremony, telling them about the history and traditions, and also showing them about some other interesting freemen who have been around, more historical ones. We have, for example, a letter from Nelson. We have a freedom casket, which was given by Florence Nightingale. We have a very nice picture of William Pitt receiving the freedom. But in essence, it's the practical aspects of it, it's still very important for the London livery companies. Now, there are 108 of those, and they're still growing. They began as medieval trade guilds, and you have mercers and haberdashers and skinners and grocers and merchant tailors. Amazingly, the livery movement is still expanding today, and we have all the more modern professions instead of the old trades and crafts. So we have solicitors, chartered surveyors, actuaries, insurers, and so on. Now, to rise within the hierarchy of the company, from being a freeman of the company to becoming a liveryman, and then perhaps on the court of assistants, the governing body, wardens, and then the pinnacle of most livery companies being the master or the upper bailiff, or the prime warden, you still have to get the city freedom to enable you to take the livery. So it's a very important part for them. Other people come to us for a variety of reasons, because they either live or work in the city for many years, they have an attachment with it, they're a member of a ward club, or maybe they work at Bart's Hospital, maybe their grandfather was a freeman, or maybe they just love London and are interested in the history of it.
So this is I'm beginning to understand it. I think this is a professional gateway in some respects, as well as an honour. And I think when I said an honour, I think I meant with a small H, a sort of a recognition.
Yes, you're right. Sometimes there is a misunderstanding between an honour with a small H, you've put it very well, and an honour with a big H. I mean, we do have the honorary freedom of the City of London, and have had that since the 18th century, and that is what most people would understand by the honorary freedom of a city, the highest accolade that the city can bestow on an individual citizen. For example, I think Manchester gave the freedom of the City of London to Sir Alex Ferguson when he won the European Cup for Manchester United, and so on. Other various worthies are given the freedom of the city, and we have that in the corporation, in the City of London, in the Square Mile, but they tend to be national figures rather than local figures. So I alluded to it earlier, Nelson, Wellington, Pitt the Younger, Kitchener of Khartoum, Baden-Powell, David Livingstone, Florence Nightingale, Winston Churchill, Margaret Thatcher's hanging on the wall over there, all the great and the good, real historical luminaries receiving the freedom, and that is an honour. They get a splendid illuminated manuscript together with perhaps maybe a gold box, or if they're a military gentleman, they might get a gold sword studded with diamonds, or they might have their portrait painted and it be hanging in the Guildhall Art Gallery. Churchill famously didn't get a gold box, but he got a wooden box which was made from some of the timbers salvaged from the great Guildhall roof, which sadly was largely destroyed by incendiary bombs in 1940, but it was a very symbolic wooden casket. Florence Nightingale famously said, "I don't want a gold box," she said. "That is far too ostentatious for a lady of my great age. Will you instead send a cheque for 100 guineas, the cost of the box, to my nursing charity at St. Thomas's, and just give me a plain and simple wooden box?" Now, I wish we were on television rather than a radio now, because we're looking at the plain and simple box, and as you can see, it's anything but. It's a massive oak casket. It's surmounted by a bronzed angel of mercy. We have lion's heads, columns, soldiers. We have the motto of the corporation, Domini de Rige Nos, Inkerman Sebastopol Crimea, and Florence's initials, FN, in enamel on it. To describe it as plain and simple is rather amusing. It is a splendid artefact of freedom, which we're very grateful to the Florence Nightingale Museum at St. Thomas's Hospital, who have loaned it to us.
One has to wonder what their idea of immodest would be. I must confess that the livery companies are somewhat enigmatic to me. I was looking at the charts of all the different livery companies, interested to see that alongside some of the predictable ones, there's also makers of playing cards and fan makers. Are they... Well, I'm going to come back to those, actually, because what I wanted to just get my head around was the concept of a livery company. So let's say I'm a solicitor, to pick one of the ones that you mentioned earlier. If I wanted to set up practice in the Square Mile, do I become part of a livery company? Does my company become a livery company? How does it work?
I think the modern ones are more sort of add-ons or adjuncts to existing professional body like the Law Society or the Chartered Institute of Surveyors. They are set very much separate entities, and essentially the modern ones are mirroring the more medieval ones. The livery companies medievally would control the trade, would control prices, quality standards, would bring young people into the companies through what was called servitude. They would also have this very important role of charity. Many companies have almshouses for old and decayed members of the company. Many are associated with education and schools. For example, you have the Merchant Tailors School, you have the Haberdashers School, you have the Cooper's School, and even one that's as plain as the nose on your face, but equally you have ones like St. Paul's, which is associated with the Mercer's Company, but they have just interestingly, opened one of these new academies in Hammersmith in conjunction with one of the newer companies, the Worshipful Company of Information Technologies. So it's a mixture of the very old, the Mercers, and the new white hot heat of technology blending together and establishing a new school.
Just to interject, I think I've just made a realisation. Tell me if I'm wrong here. When we say company, we're not talking about an incorporated, a firm, for want of a better word, are we? We're talking about a group of people.
Yes, I'm sorry. The terms are sort of partly interchangeable. I'm banding around guild, company, livery. The full title is a livery company, and you're quite right. It's not a formal company in the sense of it, but... more like a guild, if you like. I'm not very good on my legal terms, I'm afraid, but that is the essence of it. Yes, it's not a, they're not responsible to their shareholders, shall we put it that way.
So presumably the guild of I'm going to pick solicitors again because it's fresh in my mind, they could have members in various different firms.
Exactly that, yeah. The company, the livery companies started off as, say, Mercers, Haberdashers, Merchant Tailors, Skinners, but have evolved through patrimony. There are two other very important aspects to freedom, patrimony and servitude, and it all goes back to the medieval origins. Sometimes I feel I should be living in the Middle Ages. The father, it's natural for the son to follow in the father's, what he did. So if he was a cooper or a tin plate worker, the son would follow in that profession. Now, if he was born after the father had got the freedom, as a special privilege, therefore, the son would be able to take the freedom of the city on reaching the age of 21, and therefore he would then, i.e. the right to trade, and the idea is the father would gradually slow down, the son might take on the business, so it was self-perpetuating, it just went on, and then he might pass it on to his son. And then that was supplemented by a system of what was called servitude. This is apprenticeship. It's very topical at the moment, isn't it, in modern society. People are saying we should have apprentices and city and guilds rather than everyone going to university. And it worked very well. A 14-year-old would be taken on by a master. The father would pay for board, lodging and apparel. The master would pass on the skills and the mysteries of the ancient craft of being a glazier, a tin plate worker or whatever, and then after 7 years he'd serve his term. He would make a masterpiece. He'd give his master a piece of stained glass if he was a glazier, or a gold ring if he was a goldsmith, and then if that was of good quality and the highest standard of workmanship, that would be it, and he would get his freedom by servitude, and that would enable him to carry out a trade. He might branch off on his own, or he might work with a master, and ultimately the business might go to him. So this went on for, as I say, for centuries, you know, handed down. So these two aspects of freedom are still very important. Now, going back to the modern livery companies, they tend to be, if you're a solicitor, an architect, an actuary, by definition you must be a qualified solicitor, architect or actuary to be a member of the company. Now, the other companies, as I've alluded, have been diluted heavily by patrimony. They might have started off as being a grocer in the 15th century, but now they might be a merchant banker or an accountant or whatever. Some of the companies are still, or the livery companies rather, are still very connected with their original trade. So, for example, the goldsmiths, many are goldsmiths, diamond mounters, silversmiths, and you still have at the hall, you have the expression hallmark. You know this. You go to the hall for your mark. The hall is the goldsmith's hall. The mark is of the London Assay office, and the mark is actually of quality and the right amount of carats in the gold ring. And the mark is the leopard's head, which is the mark of the goldsmith's company. The London Assay office is still there. The fishmongers still employ fish meters, and they are inspection officers. So they inspect the catch at Billingsgate Fish Market. The farriers run the Farriers Registration Council. So to become a qualified farrier, you need to pass the examinations by the Farriers Registration Council, and that's still run by the Worshipful Company of Farriers. So some, and for example, the stationers, the butchers, they are very trade orientated. Members of the company must have some connection with publishing, printing, newspapers, books. It might be digital learning, but it's all within that. And the butchers likewise, they're very in the meat industry.
This is very interesting, this blending of the sort of professional and the social. And you say in some of the companies it's not necessarily the case any longer that people have a close relationship with the trade. And it reminds me of what I understand about the model of Freemasonry that people sometimes talk. What are the differences there? Is there an overlap? Or
I think, yes, the livery companies are often, people often mistake them to be quasi-Masonic. I suppose there are some connections, but they are very different institutions, and the companies are essentially, I don't think they publicise themselves well enough, really. There's a bit of a mystique about them, and people generally aren't exactly sure what goes on.
But that's not the same as being a secret organisation by any means.
No. Increasingly, they really want to let people know what they're doing. I mean, I think the last figures I saw were 2010, and the delivery companies gave £42 million to charity. And many of the companies now actually publish an annual report, which is freely available to the public if they want to view it. Certainly the Mercers do. I've seen their one, and the cloth workers, for example. So they're very keen to... they want to be known as gentlemen's dining clubs. I mean, there is an air of conviviality and fellowship that is important to the company, but much more is the aspects of charity, of education, and some links or preservation with the trade, even when it's disappeared. The companies are ingenious at reinventing a link. You mentioned fan makers earlier, and we have a splendid fan on display here in the courtroom, but not many people are having lovely 18th century fans to air themselves with now. But so what they tend to be now are ventilation engineers, a different sort of fan, of course. And we have the Welsh company of Horners. Well, in the past, horn was a cheap, plentiful material to make things that you needed, plates and cups and so on, for everyday use. Today it's plastic, so they tend to be, they've got a lot of people in the plastics industry. Mm. The glass sellers, I'm afraid a lot of our glass now is being made in China and elsewhere in the third world. But today we have a lot of telecommunications people involved in the glass sellers company because of fibre optic cables. Coachmakers and coach harness makers. Not many people are making coaches and harnesses these days, so they have very strong links with the automobile industry. So the companies are quite ingenious in readapting and having a link. Another aspect of them, of course, is strong links with the armed forces. They're great supporters of this, and often will have an affiliation with a regiment, an RAF squadron, or a ship. It was very interesting. The other week we had the Welsh Wool Company of Cooks are connected with HMS Duncan, and the CEO of HMS Duncan came for his freedom of the City of London, and our archives are fantastic in this regard. It makes it very interesting and rewarding for me, this job, because I remembered why it's called HMS Duncan, because, of course, Admiral Duncan sunk the Dutch fleet at the Battle of Camperdown in 1797, so I thought it'd be rather nice for the captain of Duncan, the current HMS Duncan, to see why it's called Duncan. And we have a wonderful on display, a beautiful, I wish you could see it again, I'll try and paint a picture, a wonderful illuminated manuscript full of imagery and pictures, and it was given to him, the honorary freedom, together with a gold sword in 1797. And we have this archive. We used to do two. We would do one for the recipient and one for our archive. And at the London Metropolitan Archive, we have a fantastic archive of freedoms from the 18th and 19th century, which I can display by revolving sometimes, not all the time, but if we need it or have a connection, we can draw it out.
I can see when you're talking about this sort of stuff that your eyes light up a little. I know that you're a historian, that your degree's in history, and I was surprised actually to discover that you're not always in here issuing freedoms. In fact, you do guided walks and things like that as well, and also helping people to find out about their own history through the freedom.
Yes, it's a fascinating job. A big chunk of the day actually is conducting the ceremonies. They're on a fairly regular basis, and people often say, do you not get fed up of doing the same ceremony all the time? But it's always very interesting, because at the ceremony they have to make a declaration. And of course, people read the declaration differently. You know, some people read it very quickly, and some people read it very slowly, and some people read it very quietly, and others read it very loudly. And we had a priest who read it to me in Latin once, and it's a tremendous diversity. And of course, in the courtroom, we have a splendid displays of paintings and pictures and artifacts from the freedom. And it's wonderful to show people different aspects of the freedom. So there is so much to talk about. You actually talk about different things and you bounce off people in different ways. But apart from conducting the ceremonies, I've got sort of two other main roles. One is as a conduit between the livery and the Court of Aldermen, which is the governing body of the livery, if you like. The corporation is somewhat unique in that it still has aldermen, whereas I think most other local government abolished them in the 1960s. But there are 25 wards in the City of London, and each of them has an alderman or an elder man, a mature man, an experienced man, and they have a separate court, and from that court is chosen the Lord Mayor and also one of the sheriffs. They serve as a sheriff first. It's a sort of a practice, a dummy run, prior to taking up the mayoralty. And the Court of Aldermen are very closely connected with the livery. One of the privileges of a liveryman is to vote. At Common Hall, he can vote in the election of the sheriff and the Lord Mayor. So it's almost the purest form of democracy. And from each court is an alderman. So now the aldermen are the governing body of the livery, and so if they want to change their ordinances or charters or constitution or have any sort of specific queries, I'm the conduit. They'll come to me first, and then it'll be referred up to the alderman. So with 108 different companies, that makes for a very interesting aspect of the job. And then thirdly, again, I find this role very interesting. A lot of historical research. So I sort of alluded to it with my researches for the Worshipful Company of Cooks and Admiral Duncan and so on. And we can often do that when we have a VIP or a significant figure coming in. We can check something from the archive and bring it out. Pavarotti came for the Freedom some years ago, and it was very... I could say, well, look, Maestro, you'll be interested to hear that you're not the first famous Italian to receive the Freedom. Here I have a picture of Giuseppe Garibaldi receiving the Freedom in 1864, the French ambassador came for the Freedom. He'd worked very closely with the Remembrancer, our ceremonial officer, in the preparation of the state banquet. And as a sort of a reward, an honour with a small H, it was given to him for the hard work he'd participated in. And of course, I was able to say, Monsieur, you're not the first famous Frenchman. Out here in the waiting room, we have a picture of Marshal Foch, who received the Freedom at the end of the Great War, given to him by, along with Pershing of the Americans and the less well-known General Diaz of the Italians. So the research is fascinating in that regard, in preparation for ceremonies. And then secondly, we get a lot of emails, letters, phone calls from wherever, all over the world, all over the UK. Grandfather was a Freeman, great-grandfather was a Freeman. Why would this be? And of course, we have a wonderful database where we can check this, and that's all very interesting.
And do you have a big team of people working under you, or is it you doing all this by yourself?
We're quite a small team. I'm the clerk. I have a deputy clerk who does a lot of calligraphy, actually, the wonderful calligraphy in the on the copies of Freedom, the parchment copies of Freedom and the Freeman's Declaration book. She's a qualified calligrapher, and the script is quite beautiful. We have two court assistants and a beadle, a splendid gentleman in a frock coat and a top hat, looking like something out of the works of Dickens, who's sort of the court usher, and he's responsible historically for good law and order as well. But today, most people are quite well behaved at their ceremonies, but they're a little nervous perhaps sometimes, so they need him to guide and steer them and tell them to turn off their mobile phones and not to take photos at this stage, but they can do it later. So we're quite a small team, but a very interesting branch of the Chamberlain of London's department. I mean, that in a sense is a bit confusing, because, I mean, what's the Chamberlain? Well,
that was going to be my next question, but I'm slightly scared of asking it.
Well, today, you and I, most people, the lay people, would call him the Director of Finance, but in the corporation, we've been around for a very long time. I think we're actually older than Parliament. We have certain officers who have very unusual titles, the Comptroller and City Solicitor, the Remembrancer, and the Chamberlain. The Chamber is a box in which the money was kept, and therefore he looks after the Lord Mayor's money. So, historically, he is... Nowadays, you'd just call him the Director of Finance. But that's interesting, why he is responsible for this ancient ceremony, which, as I said, stretches back nearly 800 years. We do have a ceremonial officer at the corporation who organises the state banquets, the Lord Mayor's show, the election of the sheriffs, and all the pomp and ceremony of the city. He's called the Remembrancer. The answer to why the Chamberlain historically has looked after it is lucre, is money. Because, of course, as I alluded earlier, the fee used to be proportionally much higher in the Middle Ages, and in fact it was a big chunk of the corporation's income. Therefore the money man looked after it rather than the ceremonial man. So for all these centuries the Chamberlain has had his court, which administers the freedom. Another important role is, of course, historically we would adjudicate in disputes. We actually were a court of law. We would arbitrate in disputes between masters and apprentices of the various livery companies of the City of London. Generally, of course, it would be the apprentices who caused all the trouble because they were drunk or idle or indolent or staying out all night or absenting themselves from the workplace or shoddy workmanship, even making merry with the master's daughters. But not all exclusively. Sometimes the master might be in trouble because he would be beating the apprentice excessively, or he'd be locking him in a garret and feeding him on bread and water, or the worst thing he could do really would be not to pass on the skills and the mysteries of the ancient art of being a haberdasher or a skinner or a merchant tailor. Anyway, master or apprentice, they'd be up before me or my equivalent, and I had much the same powers as a judge. And you, in your introduction, rather, you were painting a picture of the courtroom. In fact, the item you described as is more suitably described as a bench. It is actually a bench, a legal bench, and that's where I stand behind to conduct the ceremonies. But in those days, it was very much they were arbitrating in these disputes. Now, the powers were a stern word, a fine, or in the most extreme cases, the apprentice will be dispatched to the Bridewell lockup for 14 days, bread and water. A lot of people getting the freedom look rather anxious when I'm telling them this, but they have no reason to worry because, of course, we haven't actually had a trial in here since 1917. A pity. People often smile, but you know, for me it's a bit embarrassing at a party. You know, people say, "What do you do?" And I say, "Well, I work in a court, but I haven't had a case for 90 years."
And presumably you do retain, in theory, the powers to sentence people.
Well, we do. Very interesting. The jurisdiction still exists. It has not been repealed, and although it's dormant, no trial since 1917, it's still there. And I remember giving the freedom to a very eminent QC, Sherry Booth, and she took a tremendous interest in this. And as an expert on employment and industrial law, her eyes lit up when I said the jurisdiction was still there. And she said to me, "What is your authority for saying this?" And I said, "Well, it's Evans Austin, the law relating to London apprentices, 1890, chapter 5, page 107. And I suppose it is quite an unusual bywater of the law. And I may be surprised, not surprised that even you, as learned a QC of you, has not quite come across it." But she smiled. She thought it was very funny. I said, "You're very welcome to see my dusty copy of Evans Austin if you want." And she said, no, I'm going to rely on your wise counsel on this issue."
Now, from where does this wise counsel spring? What have you done to get to this very unusual role? What have you done makes it sound as though you've committed an offence of some kind. What's your path been to arrive here?
You are right. I mean, it's a very unconventional job, almost unique. And I'm afraid to say I ended up in it almost by accident, really. After university, I spent quite a lot of time working in housing management, social housing and housing associations and local government and so on, and I ended up on the Barbican estate, which is part of the corporation's mighty empire, technically a council estate if you like, but of course it isn't, because it's very upmarket, and we have the residents who are all, well, now it's pretty much sold under the right to buy, but the corporation maintain the freehold and are still responsible for maintenance of the lifts and the service charges and the roofs and the building maintenance and so on, and it was a very interesting job. But of course they were very articulate residents on the Barbican, judges and lawyers and accountants, and would write some dreadful letters. And as housing manager, you're sometimes a bit pig in the middle caught between the two. And so I was getting a bit disheartened. And the corporation is a funny beast, older than Parliament, like a London borough, but it isn't. It has, you know, the Old Bailey. It has its own police force. It has the mayoralty. It has swathes of, in the 19th century, great concern at the expansion of London, the urbanisation. So the corporation got by it by buying great swathes of woodland, Epping Forest, Burnham Beeches, Kent and Surrey Commons, and preserved it as a green lung for Londoner. So we're like a local authority, and we're not. We used to have before the internet, there were these blue sheets that came around, internal job vacancies, and it would be something like a surveyor or an engineer or a refuse lorry driver or something, you know, normal things in local government. And then all of a sudden there'd be verderer at Epping Forest or bridge master at Tower Bridge, or assistant clerk of the Chamberlain's Court, admitting people to the freedom, liaising with the liveries, and historical research. And I'd done history at London University and always been interested. And I applied and got on very well with my predecessor as clerk. And we used to, and got appointed, and that was it. So I literally fell into it. And we had my mentor really was a lovely lady called Caroline Arnold, who used to work here for many years. And she was very sage, and she had learnt all the mystique and the of this extraordinary job. And she was very kind to me and sort of passed on a lot of it on to me. And you sort of pick it up over the years as they evolve. Yeah.
Is there still, do you feel that there's still lots more to learn, or does there come a point where you sort of know everything about this defined area?
you're always certain questions get asked me a lot, so you know, the sheep and so on, I'm always being asked about that.
Yes, I should say we're surrounded by sheep. Every room you go into around here, there's a sheep.
Yes, I'll tell you about the sheep in a minute, but the other day, you never know. I had to do part of my role. I had a party from Colf School, which is associated with the Leather Sellers Company, a very old and established company. And usually Colf's, Colf was a leather seller in the 18th century, I think, who became a trustee of the leather sellers became the trustee of the will and set up this, or had strong links with this school, which is in Lewisham. And they always come up to the city, their city day, and they visit the hall. Now, the leather sellers own St. Helen's Place off Bishopsgate, a whole avenue, a whole road, and it's all being redeveloped at the moment. A new office and commercial premises will go up, and a new hall will be built on the site. I think it's the sixth or seventh hall on that site since the 15th century, so extraordinary continuity. But the key thing is they've still owned that land right since then. You know, different buildings have been on it. So they, unfortunately, they couldn't go and see the hall. So a past master, who I'm a previous clerk of one of the livery companies, who's a good friend of mine, said, "Oh, Murray, look, can you show them round? Can you show them Guildhall?" So I had a party. I thought they were going to be 16-year-olds, but they turned out to be 12-year-olds. But they were very inquisitive, and I gave them a guided tour, if you like, of the Guildhall, the great, splendid 15th-century Guildhall. And at the end of it, the city has a pair of legendary giants who, shrouded in mystery, Gog and Magog, who came from ancient Troy to save the ancient Britons from some dreadful fate. And one of the kids put their hand up and said, Mr. Craig, he said, how did Gog and Magog get from ancient Troy to London? And it's not a question I heard before. So in some desperation, I said, well, I think they got the 169 bus and then they changed at King's Cross. So the moral of the tale is you think you know everything, but there's always something else to be learned.
There's lots of arcane bits and pieces we could talk about here. We can't not talk about the sheep, I suppose.
Yes, I'd be a very rich man indeed for everyone, or wife or friend or member, father who's actually at this ceremony, who suddenly says, can he take his sheep over the bridge, or can she take her sheep over the bridge? I'd be a very rich man indeed if I had a £10 for that, but every time it's asked. But no, of course, you can't take sheep over London Bridge anymore, because, of course, the police take a dim view of it these days with the buses and taxis and commuters and Boris bicycles and so on. You'd cause absolute traffic chaos. We laugh about it, but of course, historically, and there we go back to the Middle Ages again, the privilege was not so much you could take the sheep over the bridge, but it was that you didn't pay the toll. And of course, in those days, you were heading off to Smithfield Meat Market to sell the sheep for a good profit, and not to pay the toll would enhance your profit margin. You could bring cattle, pigs, goats, hens, ducks, geese, livestock, any livestock, and not pay. But in the Middle Ages, the bedrock of the English economy was the sheep, was the cloth trade, the wool trade. So it's said that the sheep went over the bridge in much larger numbers, and all the other animals put together, they actually paid for the building, maintenance, and repair of the bridge over the centuries. So sheep over the bridge, but not anymore.
So we're back to that element of, I suppose, kind of protectionism or something like that, that got some of these ideas started but seem not to be happening now. They seem not to be the reasons for the continuation of these companies. I suppose my final question would have to be how you suppose it can be that some of these things that we're hearing about, these sort of suspended rights that you've mentioned in terms of the rights that you have, the rights of the free man to do this or that, the nomenclature, the roles of, the for example, the alderman. How is it that these things have been preserved in this kind of strange suspended state where they're not still doing what they were doing? They're sort of not being repealed, but then what is so special about the City of London that that's been allowed to happen?
Well, the City of London is often called unique, and I think this job certainly is. And I think part of it is what I've been trying to explain is the foundations of it. You know, these notions all sound rather romantic or perhaps strange, but the bedrock is there. You know, just as I've just explained about the business of the sheep and the right to trade, how you would literally fold up your little bit of parchment, and we still give the recipients a little pouch. It says City of London, copy of freedom, and you would literally fold it up, put it in there, and carry it about your person, as I say, like a passport or a driving license. So it's wonderful how it still exists, but it has adapted and it changes. It's symbolic, it's a piece of history, and it's marvellous that people still feel connected to it and still want to have receive the freedom. And
But what is it that's, I guess what I'm asking, what's special about the City of London that's allowed some of these roles and positions and ideas to be preserved, rather than just somebody come in and say, okay, well, this is all a bit archaic, we're going to sweep this away and replace it with something more up to date?
Well, I suppose, I don't know, it's a really difficult question. I suppose the city is not impervious to change because, of course, recently we have had reform of the franchise, where it's been widened to enable more people to vote. So there is that degree of flexibility. And of course, the city moves ahead, and the role of supporting the mayoralty, supporting the financial city, banging the drum, which is difficult in these rather troubled times. It's a blending of, I suppose, tradition with modernity. And I think the city achieves that particularly well.
We should mention, of course, that we are sitting at this large conference table and we have sporting heroes from the city, including, I was delighted to see the City of London Police Force's tug-of-war team back at, well, I'm going to have a guess. Don't tell me. I'll see if I can guess from the hats. We've got straw boaters. We've got what looks like policemen with sashes on. This fellow here, I'd say 1910.
Yeah, well, you're nearly there. Of course, we are now having the third Olympic Games in London, and the first one was in 1908, and that's the tug-of-war team from 1908, which was triumphant. And as you rightly say, they're all freemen because they were actually City of London policemen. It's absolutely extraordinary, and they're quite a beefy, brawny lot, and they won the gold medal. Now, in 1912, the British Olympic Association, rather unwisely, didn't ask the City of London police to partake, but I think a mixture of policemen from Lancashire and the Metropolitan Police, and they were well adrift. So happily in 1920, we reverted to the City of London Police Force forming the team. And again, I have a nice photo here on the table, and you wouldn't want to mix with them. They look a right bunch of bruisers. And in fact, the one fellow in the back row was actually the British heavyweight boxing champion, Alexander Sewell, a Scotsman. And Sergeant Ernest Vaughan, he of the luxuriant moustache, was actually given the honour of being the flag bearer at the opening ceremony at Antwerp in 1920, and Danny Boyle had nothing on this lot. You can see in those days they all looked like extras out of Chariots of Fire. So British chaps in blazers and boaters and carrying we defeated the Americans, and the Americans complained. They said, it's not fair, they've all got hobnail boots on. Now, of course, they would do, wouldn't they, because they're all coppers, but our plucky chaps took off their boots, put on some plimsolls, and if you'll excuse the pun, they out-yanked the Yanks again, and got the gold medal back. In fact, Britain is the reigning tug-of-war gold medal champion, because we haven't had one since, which seems a shame to me, because we have synchronised swimming and beach volleyball, so why can't we have a tug-of-war back? And
yes, we could put that obesity epidemic to good use, couldn't we?
Well, they are. Some of these chaps are very big. I don't know if they fit in their uniform, but
they look a lot bigger than your modern-day rugby player, to be honest. I certainly wouldn't want to cross those. And by contrast, next to them, in another photo display, we have someone of altogether different stature.
Well, we had a bit of magic, actually, because J.K. Rowling appeared for the Freedom of the City of London. The Lord Mayor was quite an enthusiast for Harry Potter. daughter and admiring her, almost getting the freedom for services to literature, if you like. And unusually, the court was convened over in the splendours of the Mansion House. And I said to her, "You'll feel at home here, Joe, because you're surrounded by a lot of people wearing robes." And she said, "Yes, it is positively Hogwartian." So, but I think she read her declaration splendidly, and it was a very enjoyable occasion. It's very nice to you do get to meet some very interesting people getting the freedom. People often say to me, "What was the best freedom declaration you heard?" And last year, Dame Judi Dench came along and really was a tour de force. She was a mixture of Desdemona, Lady Bracknell, Lady Macbeth, the Queen Victoria, M all roll into one. It was a tour de force. And Colin Firth came as well, and we were a bit anxious as to how he would read the declaration, because, of course, if he read it in the style of King George VI in that marvellous film, The King's Speech, we might have been there for some considerable time, yeah.
There we go, that was Murray Craig, and huge thanks to Andrew Buckingham for facilitating that interview. Answers to quiz questions. The Marchioness tragedy took place under Cannon Street Railway Bridge. The character we were looking for, the A.A. Milne character, well, of course it was Christopher Robin Milne, which was the name of both the son and the character. There's surely only one football programme it could have been. Yep, it was Match of the Day, and you may be interested, Match of the Day was aired at 6:30pm on BBC Two, and at that time that meant that it was generally only available to London viewers, as the channel didn't become available outside the capital until sometime later. The question about 1940, what first took place in London on that date and at night? Well, it was the first all-night bombing raid on London during the Second World War, paving the way for tit-for-tat retaliation and, of course, the Blitz. And finally, 1931, Ramsay MacDonald resigned the Labour government, which was replaced by, yes, the National government. How did you get on? We're going to be delving into London's history quite literally, and even further back than we have done in today's programme next week, as we pay a visit to the artefacts excavated by the team of archaeologists working with Crossrail. I hope you can join me for that. Until then, stay dry. And that's all for this week. My thanks for this week to my interviewee, Murray Craig. Thanks too to Bernie Barkley, Rachel Holdsworth, Zoe Craig, no relation by the way, and Dave Haste. Theme and incidental music was by Jack Hurd and Rory Anderson. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe. Waiting for the river's care, straining for the blueing waves calling from the shore.
New glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.